Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you will call the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way, just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
We are again. That did seem to work.
Satisfied?
Yes. So far as I ever am. I just, particularly after our last thing, and just so leery of technology.
Yeah, of course.
Although having said that, the fact that we couldn't talk last time did give me an opportunity to listen to a long talk that you gave in Australia. I guess was it last year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in Australia recently, in just now in April.
Oh, so just very recently, right?
Was it? But I don't remember what I said.
Lots of stuff. It really was very helpful. So I felt like it was actually a divine rather than a malevolent intervention that prevented us from speaking.
I'm glad there was a reason for it all.
Yeah, no doubt. That's pretty much it. I mean, this is The Limitless, so the idea is to create that temporary autonomous zone where anything can happen, mm-hmm. which for me is always kind of nerve-wracking. And I've it's funny because with you, because there's so much there to explore, I've already been feeling sad about how little time we have before we've even started.
This is the middle of an endless conversation. It's not the beginning, middle, and end of one, because you and I have been in dialogue in your book, in the pages of your book, and elsewhere, but especially there.
Yeah. Well, I thought that would be a good place to start, actually, or at least maybe even further back. I mean, this is different in various ways to other conversations I've done for the podcast. Main one being is that you and I have this ongoing relationship, and so as you say, this is a continuation of that.
Yeah.
So I thought it might be good to start with going back over how we met and
how
we got to this point.
Well, and it's become obscure to me, or fictionalized in my understanding anyway, so you might have to straighten me out.
Straighten each other out.
Or re-mythologize it. Knowing that I'm susceptible.
I'm the demythologizer, so I like to think. So, okay, so I'll give you my end, and then you can take over. I had heard about you from my wife, which is a kind of a running thing on this podcast. She brings me to a lot of people, and she had read, and we had Motherless Brooklyn, and she talked about it repeatedly. She was referring to it quite a lot over the months, and so eventually I read it. And actually I think at a certain point I realized that I already had one of your books, but it wasn't your book, but that was of course The Exegesis, Philip K. Dick. So I had seen your name, but I hadn't registered it. And then, I can't remember the exact order of things, but, I found out that you'd written about Talking Heads' Sphere of Music, my all-time favourite album. So that obviously piqued my interest in what you were doing. And so I ordered that right away. And then around about the same time, whether it was before or after I read that little book, I sent you my essay on Philip K. Dick.
Right, which is a very good one. Yeah, well, that's an amazing number of correspondences, and to have them all, you know, to have them all unveiled in a relatively short time. I mean, you know, I can imagine feeling almost sort of stalked by that roster or the Venn diagram. But I felt it in turn with your descriptions and the atmosphere of your first communiques with me, and then of course your early writing in what became that terrific book, you know, where you talked about the disappointment artist, because I take as my subject so often the kind of transmigration of one would-be artist or working, fumbling, fanish intelligence, you know, the way in which we project ourselves into these other persona. And when I first encountered Philip K. Dick at age 14, I mean, which is not to cast myself as Phil and you as, you know, a teenage Lethem in the analogy, but I remember feeling colonized, you know, and also, of course, like I wanted to become parasitical, like I was ready to just, you know, invade the brain that had invaded mine. And you put some of that atmosphere into your first communiques in a way that was disarming and seductive without being too upsetting or feeling too much like a I would end up stalked if I responded. And so I was delighted because it seemed to reply to one of the, you know, deepest currents in my work, which is how do we sort through our identifications with the other minds that activate ours? And I guess I was looking for a reader like you from the moment I, you know, began a book like Chronic City. You know, it's sort of like a message in a bottle to the right kind of reader.
Gosh, okay, so there's a lot to respond to already. One thing, I just have to keep talking, otherwise I won't say anything. How you mentioned on this Australian tour, how you, when you read a book, you have this fantasy of being the only reader of that book. Like, you want it to be completely intimate.
Yeah.
That, I mirrored that. I mean, I have that experience. And it occurred to me when I was hearing you talk about that, that I actually gave you that experience with Seen and Not Seen. Because, and to give, to fill in the backstory, after I contacted you and you gave me the really deep validation for me about the Philip K. Dick piece, I mean, it was a small life-changing event for me to have that much validation from a literary figure who I respected. So it had some psychological impact, and at the very least, it drove me to want to explore your work more deeply. And I had the experience then of reading your work, and the first thing I read was Disappointment Artist. In that intimate space, even though you hadn't written it for me, obviously, and I wasn't the first reader, obviously, because I had a personal connection to you, I was more interested in reading your work, obviously. And as it happened, I picked the right book because it's the book of yours that most that speaks to me most personally.
Yeah.
And it was through reading that that I discovered how many correspondences there were between us, not just Philip K. Dick and Fear of Music, but also the Marvel comic book, The Superheroes is a big one. Interest in neurodiversity was an obvious one from the beginning, actually. And then, as you know, you may recall, it was actually reading The Disappointment Artist which sparked Seen and Not Seen. So it's as a response to you. I mean, that book began as a dialogue with you, essentially, in that I was writing a piece that I knew I would send to you, and that became the genesis of the whole book.
Of course, it feels like an address to that book at the outset. I mean, Seen and Not Seen does a lot of different things, and I was not only in a very privileged position watching it unfold, but and getting to occasionally, you know, push it and see it move slightly in response to my pushing. But then also it became a consuming project towards the end in ways you hadn't planned that aren't announced at the outset. And so it also moves away from the dialogue with me, but it starts very strongly in those early chapters as a kind of address to me or to the implicit author of The Disappointment Artist. But I would also insist that it's a very good piece of, you know, the result, however eccentric in terms of what people's idea of literary criticism might be, is it ends up nevertheless seeming to me one of the best things that has ever been written about my work. you know, which is different from addressing me or addressing my book or using my book as a spur to your own exploration in along with all those other things that seen and not seen accomplishes, and perhaps in passing or incidentally to you, but it does some very, very fine critical, you know, discursive work on, I think, both Chronic City and Disappointment Artist.
They lives in there too.
And they live, yeah, yeah. And I admire that chapter very much. But I remember in particular feeling that you caught what Chronic City was trying to do and talked about it in a way that I'd been waiting to see anyone do for, you know, for as long as I'd had the impulse to write the book. I'd hoped to have it create those thoughts in someone else. And, you know, I mostly was unsatisfied, even though it's had some very devoted readings. And even though I know you have resistances or skepticism about some of the fiction, nevertheless, the critical acuity was really exciting for me.
That's great. It's reciprocity, however you pronounce that word.
Yeah.
It's not a word I use. That's what you're describing. As a brief aside about Chronic City, hopefully get back to it because it'll take us off track if we follow it. But I realized listening to your talk in Australia that I missed something fundamental about Chronic City, however, despite all your kind words, and that was that it was a cry of protest.
Yeah, right. There is that sort of very inchoate but very emotionally disarranged kind of political shriek encoded in the book, but, you know, too deeply, perhaps.
As I say, I think it's one for maybe later on if we get there, because I definitely want to go into that area. But I just thought I'd mention it there in terms of how I interpreted Chronic City. And as you may have got the impression reading it or got this sense, that it was a very intuitive reading of what I see as a very intuitive book. And this was part of the satisfaction, is I wouldn't have had the experience of reading Chronic City if I hadn't had a relationship with you, if I hadn't been writing about it and knowing that I was going to send my responses to you. That completely changed my relationship to the book while I was reading it. And it became kind of an act of co-creation to me, reading the book, as if I was drawing out stuff from the author's unconscious that you had put in the book, but perhaps you weren't aware of.
Yeah.
And so I didn't even know how much I was completely, obviously I was winging it, but as in intuiting it, but I didn't know how much I was actually imagining or projecting stuff in there and how much I was actually extracting it.
Well, if I want to flatter myself, I would, you know, rather than, I mean, this remark could be just seen as a kind of hedging or wanting to flatter anyone who feels activated and excited about the book into thinking that they've had a very profound experience. But if I were to credit myself, I think one of the goals in creating something like I did in Chronic City, which, you know, it's sort of impossible number of signifiers to make literal interpretive sense of, but I wanted to set up a kind of resonating interpretive field, a space in which a lot of meanings could be projected and all seem to find their, find nests, in a sense, within the space of the book. And so that, of course, means that, I myself wrote something that I can think about again and not be sure whether the things I'm feeling about it now were by design or fully anticipated, or whether they're just accepted. You might say the text accepts the my present impressions of it or my present desires for it, because it was designed to be a kind of accepting net or field for the capture of interpretive energies.
That's great. I mean, so you're talking about like a living thing. And that, I mean, because it's like a meta. Chronic City is like a meta work, because that's also what it's about in many ways.
Yeah. Well, and it's also a cautionary story at the very same time about overthinking, essentially, about the price of interpretive mania and the disarrangement and missing the forest that's possible. So it also serves as its own inoculation, you know, because it's always also saying, you know, you've gone too far, stop, dwell in your body, dance with a dog, you know, make sure you remember to eat 3 meals a day.
Right, be in the body. So that's, I could see why you might have been disappointed by the responses, because it's very, very subtle when the thing that you're describing is actually happening while you're describing it, which is what I attempted to do with seen and not seen in a different way. That can be very disorienting for the reader, and they can end up feeling like nothing has happened. That was one of my problems with seen and not seen, is if I'm writing about writing, if I'm even writing about the writing of this sentence while I'm writing it, what's going on there? It's like an infinite regression or something, where many readers, I imagine, metaphorically back away.
Yes, that's an invitation that thousands are ready to decline, absolutely, at any time. So, but that's okay. It's just there to be taken up. When it's taken up, it leads to the most profound kind of entrancement, and that's all that matters. The number of people willing to not read any given text is something that it's so fundamental and oceanic, and you know, would be totally disturbing if you thought you had to think about it. I mean, even the very greatest, if you go on Amazon and you read the readers' reviews for Moby Dick, you can find 100 people who say, well, what a waste of time. I read about 5 pages and this guy's really going on about nothing. I mean, the amount of rejection and unreading, it's a bottomless universe of...
Well, that does speak to our the dynamic of our relationship too, because I mean, as I said, you reading Philip K. Dick and your response to it, I mean rather my piece on Philip K. Dick, your response to that counted for a lot for me, because I've been seeking this validation as a writer, which I'm sure all writers seek, and because I hadn't found it through an audience, like actually having a large audience, having success, selling books, any of the more socially conventional ways to get that validation. So that happened, but then right after that I read you talking in an interview about how your own dream fantasy had been to not make it until your 50s.
To be properly marginal,
And that was really validating in its way too, because it helped me to recognize something which I'm still, as you know, seen and not seen was partly about this journey to accepting that marginalization. And so I'm still on it, but I'm definitely really close to being fully comfortable in the margins and fully recognizing why I need and want to be in the margins, which may mean I get yanked out of them, of course, if I'm not careful. So that whole question of reaching an audience and what it means, and what are the upsides and what are the downsides and what are the costs of that, and juxtaposed with reaching an audience in a much more subtle way, I can't think of another adjective, but in terms of actually reaching a single individual.
Right, making the contact that actually counts for anything. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because there are times in your, again, going back to the early, sort of the premises of our contact, where you wore on your sleeve, in a sense, that you're an atmosphere of kind of disenfranchisement, and you were astonished to get an email reply back from someone who you thought of as in some way kind of separated from you by this chasm of, you know, what it would mean to become a successful writer. Of course, I don't recognize the spatial, you know, you're seeing this sort of structure of pyramidal form or mountains and valleys, and I'm just this guy with an email account and my daily putterings and activities, always feeling, you know, a uneasy mixture of yearning and frustration and self-satisfaction, and, you know, disenfranchisement is available for me as a sensation as well. So I identify with you in that kind of initial encounter that you're kind of reinscribing here. I identify with the person tugging on my sleeve much more than I identify with the image of me suggested by by your petition to me, which is, hey, you know, impassable, famous, accomplished person with no reason to even glance in the direction of the peon. You know, it's just sort of not actually. It's a chimera, and I think it's true all the way. I think, you know, I don't know who would ever identify with that imperial. It would be a disaster to do it, and it wouldn't be true anyway. It would be an imposture. You're insecure, you know, and unsatisfied forever. And I'm aware in a way, you know, no one else needs to be. It just sounds like me complaining about all the ways in which I'm mired in unfinished, incomplete gestures, failure to connect, you know, envy, you know, discomfort, that it just, none of these things build the thing that the kind of edifice that you were speaking of. But on the other hand, I don't, you know, I know it's a kind of unattractive, doesn't really work in most conversations. And I, there's only one thing to do, which is be gracious and amazed. And I try to stay gracious. And I know I remain amazed that I have any readership at all, that people take these funny results of my obsessions as, you know, literature to, you know, embrace or debunk. I mean, I actually think I'm almost, in a sense, by definition, the minute someone starts talking about you as if you're one of the, what, 5 or 6 or 9 or 10 or even 20 or 70 important writers currently practicing, you've been overrated by definition. And I was never prepared for being overrated. I always thought everything I loved was underrated. So right. I was very much more likely to kind of get to be a frustrated dark horse. And I identified with that so extensively that it took me a very long time to realize I was, for some people, and I think for those people permanently, now going to be taken as part of the, you know, obnoxious pantheon, the kind of stuff that underrated things are much better than. And that we all need to go around saying this all the time. I mean, I've spent most of my life saying, well, you think REM is a good band, but you should be listening to Pylon. They're much better. You know, mm-hmm. It's like a ritual. And I understand my function in that ritual now, but it was a painful understanding to have settle over me. And so I'm still disconcerted when someone sort of thinks I'm not going to take them seriously or not be interested. I mean, I don't mostly read the books that are presented to me the way my books are presented, right. Which is a very strange thing. I'm mostly looking for out of print, you know, obscure things that will reactivate my sense of discovery and this privacy that you know, you were quoting my Australian talk, and I'm remembering one of the things I was talking about, which is this constant effort to reclaim my reading time, which is really the most sacred thing to me, almost outside of bodily stuff, eating and, you know, fucking and very, very basic things. My reading is how I became alive, and it's how I stay alive. And for the longest time and the most formative time, it was this private, voracious process of discovery by a series of associations, finding things in bookstores, having people press things on me, or reading the blurbs and figuring out, oh, if I like this, maybe I want to find out who that person is. But it was, had nothing to do with a conventional social capital. It took me out of that world, mercifully, happily. And now, without my noticing, you know, I'm 50. If I'm not careful, my entire reading life can be colonized by things that have to do either with conventional social capital, like, oh, here's your friend, he wrote a book, you'd better read it so you'll have good friendship, or you'll maintain your sense of collegiality with the other important writers at the moment, or here's an aspiring, you know, practitioner's work, whether it's a student I've agreed to teach or a younger colleague, And it's a way of maintaining my responsibilities and my participation, and I'm constantly reading manuscript. Or, you know, in other various ways, this secret, selfish, masturbatory, marvelous, completely antisocial life project has been blotted out by dutiful, vain, or responsible kind of reading for which I am answerable. What did you think of that? I'd better read it because someone's going to want to know what I thought of it.
Right, right. Sense and of obligation.
And so I'm desperate at almost every time, every point, to recapture the marginality of my writing, of my reading life, because it's the great source, the great battery in my experience for everything I feel. And I mean, even before we even talk of my desire to write, it's just how I feel about being alive is funded by my sense of this kind of conspiracy of secret voices in my head, you know. And it's not about social capital or duty or, you know, my professional responsibilities as a teacher. It's about me. So I have to reclaim it. I have to find things to read that no one will ever be expecting me to have an opinion of, and that I can't mistake for that other kind of thing. So it actually becomes quite urgent for me to read things that are out of fashion, out of print, that I'm not describing or discussing or advocating for, you know. And there's all sorts of traps, because then, of course, I do like being a voice of rediscovery. So then I find something that no one's given any due justice to, and I write a little introduction to it. Well, suddenly I'm participating in the sphere of social capital and prestige and commerce again.
Mm-hmm.
I have to fight that and re-marginalize my reading life all the time.
Something that my wife talks about, which is the tunes. She calls it the tunes. This is how we first met. I mean, not well. She would say we met through the tunes because she was looking into something around Scientology and Anonymous, and she was exploring, following these threads. And I was doing my thing, which as it happened at that time, was writing the first piece about Whitley Strieber, which eventually became this grueling and gruesome opus, which I've sent you now.
Yes, I've spent some time being lost in
Oh, okay.
falling down that rabbit hole for sure. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, it's a rabbit hole that I may have reached the bottom of, but it's several years later. But I was just beginning then. And anyway, so we met on this forum, and because I put the piece about Whitley Strieber there, just looking for feedback, and she responded. I didn't know that she was a she. I thought it was a he, and we got involved in a kind of debate, intellectual debate. One thing led to another. Now, 7 years later, I'm living in Canada. We're married. We have a cat. We've renovated, etc. Right? But the thing about the tunes is that I'm trying to relate it to what you're saying now. Is that it's about being in this kind of unfocused field of awareness, which I think you're talking about when you want to be able to read what you want to read, and not for there to be an agenda there. You're just following these kind of very subtle cues and
Right.
trying to isolate the voices that are meaningful to you, and that leads you deeper and deeper into wherever it is that you need to
Right,
be.
exactly right. And it's very unquantifiable because it always slips, just when you think it's, oh, this writer's doing this and that's what I'm excited about, you realize, oh, that's not even his primary emphasis. And there might be this other writer who does center in that move or that thought. Maybe I can find, it's always slipping off to the side by a marvelous process of, kind of the way water slips through rocks, completely different from the way these sturdy hierarchies of value or importance, the ideas, the kind of discursive notions that surround literary importance, relevance, and historical innovation. It's almost antithetical to this engagement with the pursuit of voices. I love the terms you've put to it, the following of threads and the pursuit of these voices.
Yeah. So it's very Dickian, actually. I mean, now that we're talking about it, it's like sifting through the kibble to find the ballast, you know? And so it's not even about the voices, much less the personalities, much less the capitalist cultural structures that promote them. It's deeper even than all of that to the signal. Like, we're in this
To the signal.
maze trying
Beautiful.
to actually find the signal that
And often somehow it seems to need to be corrupted or corroded or enmeshed in commercial trivia. I mean, it kind of needs to be kibble. It's like there's something about the signal that it energizes itself by being lost inside the kind of disaster area, not being isolated, but instead being embraced along with all the kibble.
That's the tradition of the Philosopher's Stone, isn't it? So it's buried in the mud.
Right.
So maybe some correlation with that. I wonder. I mean, this seems to be, this is what you and I have very much in common. I was, again, listening to you in Australia, and I was thinking, my God, this guy would love Seen and Not Seen. Like, if I didn't already have a relationship with you, I would just be seeing so many correspondences just in your general talk, and specifically around this love hate, and that's putting it too simply, but this conflicted, ambivalent relationship to culture, like being drawn to it and feeling this deep affinity with it, but at the same time feeling ensnared by it and corrupt, contaminated or compromised by it, and not being able to fully pull out, extract from the matrix, but somehow not being able to, well, so far not being able to actually find the thing that we're looking for in it. And for
That's great.
me,
That's marvelous.
not knowing whether it's a trick, what you're talking about here, that the real signal is deep in the kibble. Is that really true, or is that a trick of the kibble to keep us looking? Does
Right.
it matter?
That's great. That's a marvelous description. And I guess what I have come to have the inclination to add to it, and I guess also it is the in some ways the benefit, and for this I have to be really grateful. It is the benefit of finding some audience or finding some success is to realize that you know, your model, which I like very much, still presumes in a way, it doesn't emphasize complicity. It still sounds like the, you know, you might be kind of like Caspar Hauser wandering out of the forest into the culture, which has this enticement and this peril for you. And I, instead, I would suggest that it was already inside me and I am a maker of it now. And I get to see, partly because of my, you know, the thing that is the least comfortable for me, which is my enmeshment in the, you know, commerce and the systems that propagate culture, you know, with a kind of cold capitalist neutrality, just pure, just wanting to see the likes pile up on Facebook, you know, just the absolute raw, the insensate monster. But it also generates all of the life, and that I'm inside this system, you know, yes, imperiled by it, confused by it, threatened by it, but also generating the field, you know, and that talking about it, you know, the only additional note I would strike, you know, if I were cultivating the image you just proposed, which I like very much, would be to talk about some peculiar way of being both the spider at the center of the web and a fly trapped in it. You know, that we're all in this together, including as the makers and the prison keepers, you know, the jailers as well as the prisoners.
Yeah, well, that's the meta view of it, isn't it? It's that, I used the phrase a long time ago, Illuminati are us. so yeah, we're the prisoners and the prison guards, and yeah, it's a thought stopper, really, which I've got nothing against.
I mean, you make books, so they could be put to all sorts of unholy or marvelous purposes by the right mind, and you know, all kinds of authority that you don't award to yourself could accrue to them in the imagination of someone who used them to construct their own participation in the the magical prison of culture.
Well, I've had this experience. In fact, it's an ongoing experience. There's somebody at my forum, and this isn't an isolated thing, so if he's listening, I hope he doesn't feel singled out or scapegoated, but currently there's somebody at my forum who is has been very difficult to deal with, and he's like, in many ways, my number one fan. Like, he read my early books on the occult under the name of Aeolus Caphas, and he loved them, well, particularly the first one, Lucid View, and he's been very instrumental in sort of spreading the word, and like, he's been very busy on the internet telling people to read it over the years, and even buying multiple copies and giving them away, which in my own, you know, small little marginal field, it's quite significant. But I actually find I can't talk to him now. I mean, every time we enter into dialogue, it becomes fraught, and I find him very hostile and aggressive, and he doesn't know why. And so,
well, this is very familiar to me. This pattern is very, you know, I mean, we do become the antagonists, and there's nothing, you know, I talk about this betrayal. I use David Byrne as my model in that last part of Disappointment Artist, that the way I held his early work against him, and I did, you know, I didn't have the opportunity, the inclination to become a kind of a provocateur antagonist in his own mind space, but I felt that I was embittered towards this person who'd made these things that mattered so enormously to me.
Right.
It's very paradoxical, but of course that enmity that hides inside the fan is a very, very complicated system to feel ourselves caught up inside from either end.
Yeah, well, and it's with the seen and not seen model, it's like we're co-created by culture. I mean, we create ourselves and we let culture shape us. It's a symbiotic relationship, but essentially culture molds our identity, and for better or for worse, and temporarily at least. So then, as a writer, then as writers, we're doing this too, as you're saying. We're contributing to the culture that shapes people's identities. And then if people become specifically attached to our work, then clearly they are taking on components in order to shape their own identities, in order to give themselves values and meanings. And so what I discovered with this chap, and I already knew it, was that, and what I explored with Seen and Not Seen, is that I have a responsibility, very Marvel Comics there, with the power of my intellect and whatnot, that the stuff I put out there, if it's embedded with my own neurotic, drives for status and power and insecurity and all of that, my own deep issues, then that's going to get passed on to other people, and they will take it in, they will absorb it, and then very much the chickens come home to roost. It's quite fitting if I end up being stalked in the really negative sense. Not that this guy's a stalker, but juxtaposing it with how you described our relationship as being a kind of positive stalking scenario, the negative being that just that somebody's issues have really been triggered and magnified by something that I've done. And I do have a responsibility to that, just to be aware of it.
Of course, and it's embedded in what you sought to achieve. Indifference is the real disaster, right? I mean, he's alive to your work. It proves that your work is alive. Indifference is the death that we have to dread. So, I mean, I actually, as you're reminding me of something I hadn't thought about in a long time, that there were these couple of young guys who, back when people used to do kind of volunteer websites, fan sites for authors, that energy has been completely usurped by things like Facebook. But there was, when I was really kind of just really, truly a cult item, a dark horse, I had maybe three novels out when this appeared. Someone volunteered to put together a very affectionate and detailed website with that was kind of tracking my activities, and it was like the hub for Lethem fans, and it was a very charming development that I really felt honored by. And but these couple of young writers turned out not to like what happened. They felt very betrayed. Well, I mean, one of the two in particular felt very betrayed, I think, by Motherless Brooklyn and the subsequent embrace of my work by readers who they didn't identify with, that their website was sort of turned out it was only for the dark horse Lethem. And this same guy went on to review a couple of my later books very viciously on a site called Pop Matters, and it was really disconcerting because I realized, oh, he this is the I've already attained, to him, I in the space of relationship. Well, how long did it take me to feel betrayed by David Byrne? He turned around, and now I was an exemplar of everything that could go wrong with a kind of, the kind of writing he liked when it took itself seriously, or when it was taken up by a literary audience, how easily corrupted it could be. And he was a sort of avenger on behalf of my early writing against my latter work. And I felt, of course, stabbed in the heart in a sense, but I also felt there was this, like you say, powerful, kind of allegorical correctness to it, because I was creating the kind of violent desire, that I'd always exemplified as a reader myself.
So let's take a leap then, and hopefully it's an intuitive one, a good one, to what went wrong with Jonathan Leatham, to quote Jonathan Leatham.
Yeah, it's too bad about him.
Could
It's really, it really, no, I mean, things could have been very interesting.
So, but bringing back to the parent thing, because I still didn't get to it, which is how you expressed your grandmother's view that you referred specifically to the idea of freedom, and how your grandmother's view was that was critical of your mother's view, because to your grandmother's point of view, from your mother, from her point of view, freedom was not something that one could find pleasure in. Freedom was a loss of all illusions, and that there would be nothing to replace those illusions.
Yeah.
And whereas the countercultural view was somehow, woohoo, here we go, freedom all the way, it's going to be a blast, Kankizi, all of that stuff. And
it reminds me of the Zizek kind of interpretation of They Live, or, yeah, the truth hurts. But if you could actually live outside of ideology, you'd be, you know, it would be like being in space with no oxygen. Your eyeballs would explode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and this is disillusionment, of course, it's another word for disappointment. And this is very much my view, my experience as an ex-spiritual seeker who's been disillusioned even about spirituality, and mm-hmm. seeing that is, well, it's maybe not the end point, but it's a necessary point on that path, the individuatory path. But that is how I would describe it, is that it's just an ongoing loss of illusions until nothing is left but whatever is real. And nothing replaces mm-hmm. the illusions, because the aim is to get to the real. How does this relate, I guess, to what you're doing, what we're doing as writers, as culture makers? Again, because the culture of kibble, or the kibble of culture, is about illusions. No?
Yeah.
So yeah. We create illusions to hopefully lead to the real, or get to the real.
Well, I mean, yeah, this can also be seen in terms of just the terror of where culture and nature meet is in liveliness, in presence, activity. You know, underneath is the vacuum, the void, right? Or just an image of death, of kind of an anti-human uselessness, just that we don't. So you know, the culture could be seen as a frenetic filling up of the void that we stand on the brink of, right?
Yeah.
I talk about this, I guess, a little bit at the end of Disappointment Artist as well, of just wanting the books to fill in the giant howling void that I'm always sensing, and how little they can do so, but how, you know, and even in Chronic City, I have that image of the book being thrown into the giant pit, you know, that Beckett-like death artist is making, and, you know, he's making giant holes in Manhattan, and no one knows what to do with them.
Yeah, which is why I compared the book to the subject of the book to what it's actually doing, that the book creates a hole, and that does seem to be an antidote, because if we see the way that we're doing that by filling the hole, the void of meaning, with these projected meanings, then we can see, you know, where we end and the void begins. Or
right, well, but that's the other thing, is that we make objects that are not our bodies, but are not, you know, pee-pee and caca, right? We make these elevated dead objects, these exalted turds, that kind of being negotiating fulcrums between us and the void. The book is this, you know, significantly alive thing that is also significantly dead, right? It's finished. It's static. It doesn't want us. We don't know what to do with it. It's abhorrent. It's beautiful, but it's outside of us. And it's kind of a half in the void and half in our bodies. It's a kind of a zombie we can live with. Or a zombie we can also sometimes use to connect to, like, as a telephone to other humans.
Yeah. Loud.
myself clear. In front of a face that's nearer. Have I been here before? Not this close before. Never done before. Not this close before. I hear music and it sounds like bells. I feel like my head is high. I wish I could meet everyone. Think I'm a little rockin'. Think I'm all up tonight. All over again. There was up in my room. And now I'm busy again. I'm still thinking about my friends. In my guarded moments, now I'm speaking about my friends. Now I'm speaking out, thinking about my.
Squashed up here. This is what I've more and more recognized that doing this podcast is about, is connections. It's making connections.
Yeah.
And so the means, the actual product is a means to another end, which does outlast or outlive the means.
Yeah. Well, I mean, then that circles back to your anxiety about the nature of the writing and seen and not seen. But I think that book is very articulate about the fact that it became about accomplishing a journey rather than about completing a book with a meaningful boundary around it. You know, it feels and expresses very, with seemingly great confidence, its function as a pivot into connection, into a next thing, rather than being a kind of discrete, you know, complacent entity of its own. It's a kind of a, it's a moving marker on a journey.
Well, thanks. I mean, because that was, as I said, it was connecting to you that was inspiring that to begin with. And then by the end, I was connecting to my own past. I mean, it also began with connecting to my past by looking over my previous writing. So
yeah.
In a superficial way, I was connecting to a part of me.
Yeah.
And that ended up with me connecting to a much deeper part, which was much more fraught and distressing. And actually to the point that I wasn't sure I could finish the book, not because it was so painful, but because I didn't know how to accommodate the intensity of that pain and that trauma into a work that had been relatively light until that point.
Yeah.
So that is also like creating a space to relive one's own trauma and to heal within.
Yeah, I mean, it's a commonplace that one is prone to resist when it's offered, that writing is the writer's, you know, that the books are the writer's therapy, that they're fixing themselves or trying to fix themselves by writing the books. But you do, in a more sophisticated conversation, you find yourself forced to acknowledge that you are building and revising structures of trauma and reenacting them and turning them around to look at them from the back. And put your hand inside them like a puppet and notice that you can actually operate them. And so it is, half accidentally, sometimes very good self-confrontation or self-enabling healing. You know, it does happen. You wouldn't want to make it the goal of the project or it probably wouldn't happen.
Right. There's, I think my favorite title of any book anywhere is Raymond Chandler book, The Long Goodbye. And it's funny because he, it seems he also had The Big Sleep, so he's just like riffing on death, right? And coming up with poetic ways to describe death. But I've thought that The Long Goodbye is a better name or better description for life.
Yeah.
We're here for this very short time. We barely have time to say hello, much less goodbye.
Yeah.
And that, that's the kind of thing that we don't talk about because it's so painful, that reality. I mean, it's about the void, you can talk about the existential
We make little allegories for it. We make little stories about it. It's funny because it's everything. I mean, there's the Groucho Marx song, Hello, I Must Be Going. Right. And I remember as a kid feeling that there was some wisdom hiding around the edges of that joke, if I could find it. And then somewhere, I'm a big baseball fan, and somewhere in my reading, I read about the baseball of the time just before I was conscious of the 60s and the early 70s all the time. And there was a great pitcher for the Philadelphia Phillies named Steve Carlton, who was surly with the press. And he was just, his accomplishments are extraordinary, but he was a pill. He was unpleasant. And some sports writer, just as he was retiring and he was done and it was sort of valedictory moment, he suddenly became forthcoming and talked to him. And it's a kind of, in spirit, almost a vengeance, the sports writer wrote a piece about he learned to say hello just as he should have been figuring out how to say goodbye.
That could apply to all of us, I think.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the baseball, so that gives me a nice, easy segue to, before we start tearing up here, to something I really wanted to, and I have no interest in sports and no interest in baseball, anything like that. I have an anti-interest. I'm hostile towards sports, but it's a childhood thing, or it's something I've brought all the way into adulthood from some, I don't know where. But anyway, it's actually come up twice in the last week's sport, and in both cases I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. So, and the first case was when you were talking in Australia about the Mets, mm-hmm. and how you discovered that even though you saw them as the underdogs, and so that was the way that they got your love, in a sense. Mm-hmm. You found out later that it was all a kind of ruse or a subterfuge of capitalism to prevent actual independent community sports teams from taking off.
Right? Yeah, the inception of the creation of my favorite team, my lovable underdogs, was the backstory is kind of a civic bribe. There was the threat of community-owned baseball teams, and this was a way of thwarting it, was to award New York City with this glamorous new privately owned team instead.
Right. So for me, while I was listening, a lot of things were firing, because this came after your description of your grandmother and her view of freedom being absolute no compromise, abandonment of all illusions, versus the whole countercultural thing, which seemed to be saying you can have your cake and eat it. You can have freedom, but you can also take along, all of these nice values, these ideologies with you. Mm-hmm. So, and then the thing with the Mets, it struck me that that's a, because I sent you the Prisoner Infinity thing, which is all about social engineering, which is one of my leading interests, that's a little microcosm, the Metz thing, of how that works, of how capitalism creates a surrogate of the thing that is the threat.
But it's also, you know, it points you back to the kind of the impurity of the finding the, you know, the threat of culture, the voice that you need in a kind of contaminated area of, you know, commercial kipple, right? Because on the other hand, the love, the kind of weird quasi communion that I enjoy with other Mets fans, the vehicle for it is this utterly cynical and corrupted, you know, container. Mm-hmm. Yet what happens inside it, you know, it's a temporary autonomous zone. Sports fandom at its most, if I allow myself to idealize it the most, it's a place where we commingle in an egoless, you know, kind of a bath of human affection for tribalism. It's like a Kurt Vonnegut crass. People feeling connected just to feel connected, right? Mm-hmm. The vehicle, the container is this commercial, in, as you know, as you're reminding me, the sort of bribe, there's an original sin at the heart of it, and yet it still occurs the same way. You know, the science fiction convention takes place at a hotel in the suburbs that doesn't care about it, just wants to, you know, collect the money from the people who eat in the restaurant and drink at the bar. But the communion that occurs inside that space could be an exalted thing. You know, if you're too much of a purist, you might miss that beauty arises, you know, the rose grows in the shit field, right, sometimes. And I guess I'm, you know, I'm on the side of the impure if I have to choose.
Well, my brother was always saying, or at least he did say, and sometimes quite vehemently, that the pure and the impure can't be separated. They're always mixed.
Right. Well, and that's to say that the impure wins, because the impure is...
Right, that's right.
...more tolerant of the mixing than the pure is.
Yeah, totally. That's 100% inarguable logic. I'm a purist, though, as you may have...
Yeah,
picked out, and I'm quite ambivalent about that, because I agree. I mean, what you were saying earlier about accepting that we're flawed, being the only way to actually live, but I think that there's a kind of paradox in that, because if we really accept ourselves as we are, then that's a letting go of all the things that prevents us from being who we are.
Right.
And so that there is a purity, there is a philosopher's stone in the dirt, I really believe that.
Yeah.
But maybe I have to believe it. I mean, of course, how do I know? How can I know, except by digging?
Maybe you would, you know, listening to that, a diagnostician might say, devise a self-validating paradox where the philosopher's stone in the dirt is the purity of your desire to believe that there is meaning in the in the pursuit, right?
Right. So the attitude of the observer affects the outcome of the experiment. Right. Yeah. So bringing it to this example we're talking about, more specifics, to me it has to do with, okay, so you and I, we grew up on Marvel Comics.
Uh-huh.
And we have that affinity, but we both know that Marvel Comics are kid stuff, and they're not what we thought they were, and the movies are here to kind of prove it, that they're sort of infantile fantasies of empowerment by mother-bonded egos, or however we want to break that down.
Yeah.
But we can still connect, like the parts of us that connected to those archetypes and those cultural commodities, is real, even though the thing that we connected to isn't. So you and I can still connect,
right?
Not through those shared affinities, but with the parts that actually it relates to the affinities, but what I'm getting at is that that relates to me, that relates to how willing you and I are to see through the illusion and admit that, yeah, the Mets never were really underdogs, that that was just a capitalist scam.
Right.
And I can still love the Mets, but I can't really believe the part of me that loves the Mets, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's good. That's right. But your use of comics as the emblem in your comparison, if we shift to that, offers another thought that might be helpful, or at least worth trying to unpack. And this goes into my thinking very much, because you're suggesting this sort of dual view where we remain enchanted and disenchanted with something like comics. And as a practical matter, when you go back to the Marvel comics or any comics that entranced you, the way they tend to entrance you. I think this is, for me, especially true of the Marvel comics of the 60s and early 70s, and I just don't know how transferable this description is outside of it, but I don't need it to transfer. I'll keep it right there. That those comics can seem weirdly, you know, crapulous and thin when you go back and try to revisit the exact episodes or sequences that matter so much to you, and yet they also remain charged as a kind of vehicle for your search. And this to me connects to, and this is where I'm going to switch to being almost a kind of a you know, talking in terms of formalist literary criticism, that the meaning and the power in so many of those comics, and in comics per se, has to do with the vacuum, the space, the gutters between.
Mm.
Where your mind has to make this extraordinary leap to connect, well, first within one panel, to connect the verbal stuff, the balloons and the captions, with the drawing. And actually, when you go back and look at it, even within the space of one panel, there's often a tremendous degree of incongruity or disassociation between the style of the drawing and the mood of the drawing and even the action of the characters and what words are being spoken in the word balloons or their thought balloons or in the captions. So there's a leap being made, an interpretive fusion is required in the mind of the viewer, the reader, to put those elements together. And an even greater leap is required immediately thereafter to jump from that panel across the gutter, this apparently inconsequential gap of nothingness, but it's actually a terrifying, abysmal space that we just learn to ignore, to the next panel and animate this totally static, inadequate, confusing, self-contradicting next drawing to the one before it. And this action is such a form of human liveliness and projection and creativity.
Yeah.
That what matters in the comics perhaps is the action of the reader in enlivening all of this stuff. And so what you and I share, even though we might say, oh yeah, we both read that same issue of Fantastic Four, you know, number 72, where such and such happens, and we reminisce fondly about, you know, Ben Grimm briefly becoming human and then he wants to get his rock head back because Alicia only loves him as a monster, whatever it might be. But it's what we're really, what makes us one at that moment is that we both committed ungodly resources of our own creative spirit to collaborating with those drawings, to make them into something large and to uncover their implications. Some of them, of course, accidental, half-assed, barely intended or cynically intended by the creators. And it's in that, what you might call the formalistic urgency of our work to make those comics live, that we are as one through them.
Hmm.
You know, so again, it's about complicity and the interpretive energies, which become so potent that they become creative. They make a world.
It's also about connections. What you're talking about there, not just connections between you and I, or any two individuals who are performing the same miracle, in tandem and possibly with the same material, the same archetypal material, but the connection that you're making as the reader, you're connecting these worlds, these panels that aren't really connected except by an abyss, which is a paradox, right? The abyss doesn't connect, it separates. And this is very Eastern, you know, this sort of very mystical, because the idea that there is an idea, that the creation is constantly appearing and disappearing in these they talk about these gaps in consciousness that the meditators seek to find and slip through. So we have thoughts, and then we have micro thoughts, and then we have micro thoughts. And if you reduce yourself, your attention, to a small enough point of observation, then you can find the gaps and slip through the gaps. And in those gaps, that's the abyss, the creation has gone. So it's like the whole universe is this pixel, not perhaps not pixelated, but you know, the way that movies work, it appears to be moving, but actually they're still frames.
Right.
And so we're constantly doing that the whole time anyway. We're stitching together a sort of series of flat images.
Oh, of course. I think that the reason that's important is that, I mean, neurology has essentially begun to prove, I think, neurological study, that consciousness itself arises from this narrativizing, stitching, fiction-making, coherence-making urgency, because the chaos is so overwhelming. We have to constantly be breathing stories into the dead spaces,
right.
Coherent, irreconcilable, you know, fragments that surround us.
Yeah, so that's the story-making impulse goes as deep as consciousness.
Yeah,
essentially.
So the only one that trumps it is occasionally the need to get lunch, and I'm starting to drift in that direction.
Morning birds screamed all night. If there was just a little light left, something to grow into panic.
You have been listening to Jason Horsley talking with Jonathan Lethem on The Liminalist, the podcast. Between the second part of this conversation, will be up at horticulture.com on Wednesday, the 26th of August. For more about Jonathan Lethem, go to jonathanlethem.com. If you'd like to support me in this podcast, you can leave comments at the blog, website. You can email me at jason@horticulture.com. You can join the forum and the community link at the website. Or you can donate via PayPal in the margins of any page at the website. If you'd like to buy Seen or Not Seen, you can do so via the website. Or you can download a free PDF. Also, you can follow me on Twitter. That's at Jakephas, 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 at Twitter. Also, if you want to help spread the word for this podcast, tweet it, share it on your Facebook, etc. Every little bit helps.
You know, it'd be a justified sin. You know, it'd be a justified sin. You know, it'd be. Something to grow into panic.
move. I miss you. I can't move. I miss you.